Hello, everyone. My name is Greg, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Hey, Greg.
As I was coming out of my house to come to the car tonight, excuse my allergies, skies opened up. I choose not to see that as a portent of doom for what's about to occur. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and I will never be able to repay the debt for what was so freely given to me. However, at the end of this evening, if I fail to inspire sufficiently, you can blame Steve or Mike. Don't shoot me, I'm only the piano player. That's 5 points for the Elton John reference. Okay, so I was born in 1962, which means I'm 61 years old. I don't know how the hell that happened. I have no explanation for that one. I was born and raised in the Northeast Bronx. I know a lot of people have an idea of the Bronx in their head, and part of that is true, but the Northeast Bronx is really nice. Lots of parks, lots of greenery, it's beautiful, and actually it still is to this day. It was a safe and affluent neighborhood, an idyllic sort of place to grow up. But we were poor. And when I say poor, I mean public assistance poor. Not all the time, but most of the time. I was raised by a single mother, and I'm the oldest. I had a brother 2.5 years younger than me. So for most of my early years, it was me, my brother, and my mother. My mother was a waitress, and that meant that however much money she made that day was how much we had to eat. And throughout my whole childhood, we were food insecure and housing insecure. But in spite of all that and the things you're going to hear coming, I thought that I really had a rather happy childhood. We were surrounded by family members and friends. We played baseball in the summertime in the streets and hockey and football in the wintertime. And I discovered two of my great loves that are still loves to this day, which is baseball and reading. So I actually thought that I had a rather, you know, happy childhood. I still think that. The first time I ever tasted, well, I'm going to say that my mother had a drinking problem, but she never drank in the house, so I never saw it. She would not do it frequently, but she did it regularly. And what happened is we would have days where she would sleep the whole day. And we would push the furniture together and play whoever stepped on the floor was in the lava. And feed the dog things we shouldn't have been feeding the dog. It wasn't until I got older that I realized she slept all day because she was, you know, blackout drunk and she was sleeping it off. But I never saw it. It wasn't in the house. There was no alcohol in the house. I have many members of my family that are alcoholics and drug addicts. My first taste of alcohol, I think I was about 10, and we were over at my grandmother's house, and the only reason I noticed was because whatever they were drinking was green. It was in, you know, like a highball glass. So I walked over and I said, "What's that?" So they giggled and they said, "Oh, you want a taste?" So I said, "Yeah, sure." I have no memory of what it tasted like, and I have no memory of what any effect it would have had on me. But that was the first time that I ever tasted alcohol. When I was about 11, my mother married. Because my father, I never remember living with my father, and I only have a couple of wisps of memory. He just took off wherever. My mother married, and she married a violent alcoholic. And the first thing that he did was he moved us away from the Bronx to Tampa, Florida. So he moved us away from our whole support system. And that's when the nightmare began. Just the level of violence was horrific. I mean, plates of food being thrown at the wall, screaming. On two different occasions, I watched him beat my mother almost to death. And the thing, believe it or not, the thing that I remember most about it, and I can still summon this if I care to, I can still bring back the feeling. The worst thing was lying in bed or sitting on the edge of the bed at evening, waiting for the lamp to hit the wall, waiting for tonight was going to be the night the screams were going to start and the violence was going to start. And I can still remember what that feels like, that level of anxiety. And, you know, we were children. Shouldn't have to face stuff like that. So the violence would get really bad, and we would pack our suitcases during the day when he was at work, and we would hide them under the bed or in the closet and put clothes on them. And after he passed out, we would pick up the suitcases and we would go out the door. And we had to walk because my mother didn't drive and has never known how to drive. And we would walk with no aim of where we were going. We would end up in churches, near strangers' houses, bus stations, wherever. And we did this multiple times. We would go from Florida back to the Bronx. And then he would call up on the phone or send letters saying he had quit drinking and he had changed now and he was going to church now. And she would go back. We would go back. And this happened like three or four times, just going back and forth. And of course, it never changed. Of course, it never changed. But we were in such a vulnerable position, you know, a woman and two, you know, young children. And one of the indications of this was one night we were staying at somebody's house that we barely knew. And I was in bed but awake. And the person whose house it was climbed into bed next to me and put their hand on my leg. I moved away physically, and that rebuffed the attempt. So I don't know whether an attempted molestation counts as a molestation, but either way, it was pretty horrific. And really, at the time, I didn't think anything of it. It was just like everything else that was horrible in my life. You know, it was just it was another brick in the wall. 5 points for the Pink Floyd reference. I'm keeping count up here, by the way. So we eventually went back to the Bronx for the last time. And he did follow us, but in the Bronx, he didn't have nearly as much influence because we had all our family around, including an uncle who was a cop 2 blocks away. So he drifted away, and that was the end of that. But by that time, you know, my mother was, I always knew that my mother loved me, and grandmothers and cousins and everybody around, I always knew that I was loved. However, my mother had so many of her own issues that it was really hard for her to, you know, pay attention to what we were doing. I was the oldest, so I had to look after my brother. And then in Florida, my mother had a daughter with this violent alcoholic. She's 12 years younger than I am. So I had to look after the both of them now. And the way that it worked was as long as I was looking after them, she didn't pay any attention to what I was doing. I kind of had free rein, which I thought was cool at the time, but was really pretty horrible. I was a teenager in the Bronx during the 1970s. If anybody knows about what happened to New York City in the 1970s, it was bankrupt. And the mayor at the time of New York City asked Gerald Ford for a bailout, and he said no. And the back of the Daily News said, Ford tells New York City, F you. And New York was in really, really, really bad shape. Crime was rampant, and that's the time when the expression "the Bronx is burning" came up, because landlords would just set their buildings on fire because they couldn't, you know, nobody could afford the rent, and they burned them for the insurance money. I saw people fornicating in the streets. I stood in a doorway and watched a riot unfold right in front of me. And the reason that I bring this up is, like, this is the environment that I was growing up in with no real supervision. So what happened is, my mother had a sister, younger sister, who lived in the Bronx near us. Her husband was the cop. She had another sister who lived on the eastern of Long Island, and she had 5 boys. And we would go visit them once a year, and they would come visit us once a year. And when the 7 boys got together, it was mayhem. But when I was 13, the summer I was going to turn 14, just for high school, the cousin that was just older than me from the eastern of Long Island came and moved to the Bronx for a little while. And he said to me, you know, he said, I don't know where to get any, you know, grass. He said, can you get that for me? And while I did not do it myself at the time, I was dimly aware that some of my classmates were doing it. So I got something for him. And he would do it in front of me, and he would laugh and giggle and act like it was the, you know, funniest thing that in the world. And he asked me if I wanted to do it, and I said no, and I said no, and then eventually I said yes. So I tried it. And I don't remember anything about that first time, but I will just say that grass and nicotine were the only substances I ever used every day of my life. So it began a long love affair with that substance. He was old enough to buy beer because the drinking age was 18 at the time. And it was hard for us as kids to get beer because nobody would sell it to us. And you could ask an older kid to buy it for you. And he might buy it for you, but he might also just push you down and keep your money and say, get out of here, kid. So alcohol wasn't around very, wasn't really available for us. But my cousin could buy it. So he started buying beer while he was, you know, doing the other thing. And one day he said to me, he said, you want to try it? So I said, yeah, sure. So it was Budweiser he was drinking. So he handed me the Budweiser, and I remember this like it was yesterday. I took a sip of it, I handed it back to him, and I said, that is disgusting. And he said something to me that was very prophetic. He said, don't worry, you'll get used to it. And he was right. But really, all through my teenage years, it was very rare that we had alcohol. I had a friend who worked in a restaurant in the summer. Every now and then, he'd leave the back door open, and we'd steal a case of beer out of the back. But even then, my friends really liked it, but I would just like have one or two just to keep the cotton mouth at bay. And they would make fun of me and call me a lightweight, and I didn't care. But this time, I'm moving on to other substances, hallucinogenics, whatever we could steal out of our aunt's medicine cabinet when they weren't looking. Just, we were taking things, we didn't even know what it was. At the age of 15, I met two guys in high school that were starting a band. And they asked me if I wanted to be in the band. So I said, yeah, sure, because every teenage boy in the 70s wanted to be in a band. So me and these two other guys commenced to teaching ourselves how to play the guitar. And we had visions of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We learned to play the rock and roll, we got the drugs, so two out of three ain't bad. Yeah, and at the age of 16 was the first time I ever got drunk. I had stopped going to school by the second half of 10th grade. I went to school, but I didn't go inside of the school. And one day we were hanging out at one of my band members' houses, and he got into his father's liquor cabinet and got out a bottle of Canadian Mist whiskey, and we mixed it with Great Kool-Aid, which is just as gross as that sounds. And we all got really, really, really drunk. And I thought it was amazing until 3 hours later when I was on my hands and knees throwing up everything that was in my stomach and even some things that weren't. But even after that, I still didn't regularly use alcohol. I started regularly using alcohol at 17 because I had my first real girlfriend. Prior to that, I was just, you know, chasing each other around on the schoolyard, puppy love sort of stuff. And she drank. And so because she drank, that meant that I had to drink. And she drank Bacardi and Coke. So I drank Bacardi and Coke, and it always made me sick, which is really romantic. And after that relationship ended, I never drank another Bacardi and Coke in my life. Also at this time, I was 17 and the drinking age was 18, so I was just beginning to get into bars. Some bars would look the other way if you were close enough. But even still then, I would buy one or two because if you're in the bar, you gotta spend money. But I was still using other substances at this time. Yeah. So what happened is my mother's younger sister, who lived near us in the Bronx, died really tragically at the age of 33 of a brain aneurysm. And my mother decided to move out to the Eastern End, Long Island, to be near her other sister. We were always constantly moving. Constantly, the rent would go up, we would constantly move. So I never dated the girl next door or went to prom, because I was always the new kid in school. That was one of the reasons why I always wanted to make sure that my children had a home to grow up in, and I did accomplish that. So we went to the Eastern End of Long Island, and the great thing about going to the Eastern End of Long Island was I already had a built-in friend group. I had five male cousins, and they drank, and they drank beer. So what happened was I began drinking beer to hang out with them, and I was able to handle beer much easier than I was able to handle liquor, and I didn't get sick as often, and so I commenced to becoming somebody who drank lots of beer regularly. At this time in my life, I was far enough along in my addiction that I was sort of just aimless. Any job that I got was just to get money to party. And when I was 22 years old, one of my friends, I was present when his father said to him, he said, hey, he said, you know, I'm going to retire from the post office in a year. He said, and it's so isolated out here. He said, if you take the test, you know, if you pass the test, probably nobody's going to bid on this job. And my friend was like, yeah, Dad, like I'm going to go work for the post office like you did. And I said, I'll do it. So I actually cleaned up my act for a little while. And I did something that I've always done and I still do to this day. Whenever something is new or newish, I read everything that I can possibly get my hands on about that. I still do that to this day. And I found out by reading a book that were actually companies that sold courses on how to ace civil service tests. So of course I got the course, and I studied it, and I went around introducing myself to the mailmen, and I was telling them, "Oh, I'm going to be working with you next year." And they were like, "What? Who are you?" So anyway, I took the course, I took the civil service job test, because they used to just give them to the public. They'd put it in the paper, civil service test, you know, September 29th and 30th at the Riverhead Convention Center. And there would be a room with thousands of people in it, just tons and tons of people. So I went in and I took the test and I scored a 97. And I was more than a little annoyed that I didn't score 100. So that's my sort of perfectionism. But it was enough to get me the job. So I got a job as a federal employee. And you would think that this meant that I, you know, embraced the new level of responsibility in my life, right? Not a chance. Not a chance. I was making more money than I'd ever made in my life, and more money meant more partying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can see where this is going. Right after I got the federal job, I started getting arrested. I got arrested once a year now for the next 5 years in a row. But I belong to a very, very powerful union, one of the most powerful in the country. I'm still a member of that union. And so I had certain protections at work. And all you had to do, it's a small town, relatively small town, all you had to do was hire the lawyer that was connected with the judges and the cops and everything, pay the lawyer, pay the court fees, and you could get away with it. And the first couple of arrests, that's exactly what happened. I got away with it. It was like the first one was like loitering. And cops rolled up and we were drinking on the beach at like 2 o'clock in the morning. They arrested us for loitering. Hired the lawyer, got out of that one. The next was a DWI, but this was right before the DWI laws got really, really strict. So again, I got out of that one. All I had to do was go to some stupid class and that was it, it was waived. The third one was a minor possession charge. Once again, got dropped down to something, I don't even know what it was. The fourth one was drunk in public. And the fifth one was my second DWI. And by this time the laws had changed and I was in trouble. And I lost my driver's license for 9 months. And all these prior arrests, all that happened to me was I got thrown in the local lockup, which was just like a small room, and they just throw you in there by yourself, and you slept it off, and you went home the next day. But by the time of the fifth arrest, they were getting used to my face, and they were getting tired of me. And they said to me, next time we're going to send you to real, you know, jail, like the big jail. And I was like, oh, no, I can't go to the big jail. So that charge actually stuck. And so I have a misdemeanor driving while intoxicated on my record. But I had a moment of clarity on the floor of a jail cell in Southold, New York when I woke up. I thought to myself, you know, maybe, just maybe, if I wasn't wasted all the time, maybe these things wouldn't be happening to me. And so I had a coworker who I used to party with, who had gotten sober a few months before. And he said to me, he says, hey, you know, if you ever, you know, want any help, he didn't like ram it down my throat. He's like, if you ever want to, you know, go to an AA meeting or whatever, you know, I'll be happy to take you. And in my head, I was like, yeah, if I ever drank like you, I would need Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, that's not me. I was a binge user. I would use like 2 or 3 times a week. I would get really, really wasted. Then it would take a day for it to wear off. And then another day for my built-in forgetter to kick in, and then there I go again, you know, and another. I failed to mention that the reason that I reached the point for the moment of clarity was I started doing that drug that you snort up your nose. And that was actually really a blessing because I went downhill really fast. I ended up in the hospital. My last couple of arrests were associated with it. And at the very end, we began smoking that substance, and if I was going downhill, now I fell off a cliff. And my appearance was really bad shape. My employers didn't hesitate to tell me that. All my relationships, whether familial or romantic, were, you know, just disasters. During this whole period of time, you know, I can remember that I had relationships with women and I had friends, but I have almost no memory of it. Like, I have like the smallest wisp. Like, I did do it, And I have no memory of it. And that's actually pretty frightening. So anyway, the day that I got out of jail, I went to this guy I worked with and I said, listen, I need help. And he said, all right. And my postmaster at the time was not sober himself, but his wife and his daughter were. So he said to me, listen, he said, if you do this, He said, I'll protect you. I'll stick up for you. So I said, I'll do it. I'll do it. So that guy who turned me on to AA became my sponsor and is still my sponsor to this day. I was just with him 2 nights ago. He lives in New York, but we talked by phone, and I've been going back and forth every 6 weeks or so because my mother is dying of cancer, and so I've been spending quite a bit of time with him. And so he said, listen, I can't go with you tonight, he said, but you go to the hospital. There was a hospital in town. He said, you go to that meeting, and tomorrow night, Thursday night, I'll meet you at this other church. So I said, okay. I rode my bicycle because for the next 9 months I was riding a bicycle. And there was a rehab on the top floor of the hospital. So the meetings were rehab meetings. And not to disparage rehab meetings, I'm sure they help a lot of people, but it was kind of strange because the rehab people were all forced to be there and most of them didn't want to be there. And so they were disruptive, they didn't pay attention, and it just seemed odd. And as I was sitting there, I was like, you know, I was like, I don't think this is for me, you know. And this was back when they still had smoke breaks at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. You'd go for 45 minutes, then they'd break for 15 minutes and come back for another half hour. So I said, I'm too embarrassed to get up and walk out, so I'll wait for the coffee break, and I'll leave then. And that was what my plan was. When the coffee break came and everybody walked out, I ran into somebody I knew, somebody that I had used with. And he said to me, yeah, my life has gotten so much better, and you know, I'm doing better at my job and with my family. I said, really? Really? He said, yeah. And so that inspired me to go to the second half of the meeting. So I went back. The next night I went to a regular AA meeting on a Thursday night that would end up being my home group. My sponsor was there, and he said, okay, you're going to buy the cookies and make the coffee. I said, I don't think I should make the coffee. I said, I don't drink coffee, and I don't know anything about making coffee. I said, it'll be terrible. He said, all coffee at AA meetings is terrible. Don't worry about it. So that was my first commitment. And I went on to become, you know, treasurer and, you know, chairperson. I was the intergroup rep eventually, the GSR representative eventually. And I started going to meetings. They told me to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I did 90 meetings in 90 days. One of the really cool things was there was a small group of young people. And we all started hanging out together. And they had to come pick me up and drive me home every night because I didn't have a car. And they did. And not only did we do a 90-90, but we started traveling and going to meetings. It was really very exciting. And I started to feel better physically pretty soon, you know, because I'm only 28 years old. So I start to feel better. Physically, I'm able to hold my head up a little bit. I'm not as ashamed, you know, of the things that I had done. And it was really a very exciting time. I was very excited about it. And, you know, these people seemed to know what they were doing. They had their clothes on the right way out. They had jobs. They had, you know, marriages and families and so, you know, it's like I wanted what they had. And I'm just going to take a second to tell a story here. Over the last 2 months, I happened to be in AA meetings in this area where I heard a phrase uttered, and the phrase was, working the steps the right way. I've been coming around for a long time, and that really puzzled me. It's like, wow, I never heard that there was a right way to work the steps. I thought as long as you were honest, open-minded, willing, and you did it, however you did it was fine. That's the way it worked for you. It's not the same way it works for you or you or you, but that's the way it works for me. And I have a little story I want to tell that represents that. When I was about 7 months sober, we started going to conferences in different states, Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, Vermont. We even went out to Ohio for an international conference. I went to Dr. Bob's house and went to his gravesite. But the first one I went to was in upstate New York. And conferences are usually Thursday is opening day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday is closing day. Most people go on Friday and Saturday, and they kind of skip Thursday and Sunday because Friday and Saturday is when they have the dances and all that stuff, and the dinners. So, but anyway, we got there on Thursday. So I got to meet like the people that were putting on the conference, like the locals. It's usually put on by the local groups. And as we were talking, somebody said to me, oh, have you done the fourth step yet? And I said, no. The way that people tended to do it on the eastern end of Long Island where I got sober was they did it slowly. And so I was just at the point where my sponsor and I were talking about it, and I was getting ready to start writing. But they were in shock when they heard that I hadn't done the fourth step. As far as they were concerned, if you didn't do all of the steps immediately when you came into the room, there was no way that you could possibly stay sober. So they offered to take me in a room right there. They're like, come on, let's go in this room and we'll do it. And if not then, we'll do it over the course of the weekend. And I politely declined. And I remember thinking to myself, gee, I don't know how that could work. But you know what? I was wrong. Because it worked for them. It wouldn't work for me, but it worked for them. So however it works for you, as long as you do it, that's the right way to do it. So, you know, step one was really easy for me. Obviously, my life was completely unmanageable. I had tried all the different ways to control my using, do it on the weekend, do it only when you had the next day off. Of course, none of that worked. And so I was caught in a, you know, self-destructive cycle, and I lacked tools to stop it. You know, and so when I came, I was ready. I was ready to be done. I was done. Because I had already been in jails, I had already been in hospitals, and so I was ready. You know, step two, I trusted that, you know, living a more healthy lifestyle and with the support of the group and working towards self-improvement, you know, that things would, you know, improve for me. And then step three, I realized that the group could help me do what I could not do for myself. Obviously, these people knew what they were doing. I did not. And so I surrendered and did all the things that they told me. I did step four with my sponsor. But the real moment of awakening came for me when I did step five. I gave life to all the things that I had done, the parts of my personality that had become distorted through, you know, just being wasted all the time. And I gave it life in writing. But then when I told my sponsor, I gave it voice. And there was something about doing that was really, really powerful for me. And I remember walking away from that experience feeling like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders. I want to point out that when I came into AA, I also went into personal therapy at the same time. I did them both for years, and I know that neither would have been as effective without the other. So, and when I did step five, there were a couple things, mostly things that happened to me before I started using that I was deeply ashamed of, that I shared with a therapist and not with my sponsor. I wanted to tell a professional. And the professional said to me, oh yeah, those are things that happen to all people that grow up in homes, alcoholic homes. And so that I no longer had to feel ashamed, you know? And during, I think like my third year of sobriety, I did adult children of alcoholics work and all that stuff. So, you know, told everybody about the molestation and all the things that, you know, I was ashamed of, and really was able to work through all that. So that was really, really, really helpful, therapy and AA at the same time. So I was really rolling at this point. I was so excited about the changes that were taking place in my life. And for me, step six and seven were about, you know, working on those things. I heard somebody call character defects the parts of our personality that became exaggerated because of our using. I like that phrase. So I was ready to dig into all that stuff, you know, that all those things I did and all the patterns that, you know, led to me to doing those things. And step eight, I made a list. You know, my fourth step included a lot of people on that list, but some others I had to add to it. When I first got sober, I made some cursory amends to my family, but then at step eight and nine is when I actually made detailed amends, particularly to my family and my coworkers, because those are the people that were around me like every day that were being subjected to my nonsense. And I found almost to a person that people are like, oh yeah, okay, great, you know. And they were just happy that I wasn't doing it anymore, you know. But everybody was really, really very kind about it. And every one of these steps that I took forward just kind of added to the, you know, the excitement that I was feeling, these changes, you know, that I was enacting in my life. Step 10, 11, and 12 are the maintenance steps, you know, they're the steps that, you know, I use, you know, in my life. Step 10, I, you know, daily self-reflection to make sure that, you know, moving in the right direction as far as my behavior and not in the wrong direction. If I have to make any amends and say I'm sorry, then I do that. I'm going to skip step 11 for just a moment. I'll come back to it. And step 12, I did lots of service work in my early years in the program. But now my service work is just coming to meetings, shaking everybody's hand. I shake the speaker's hand and the chairperson's hand, and anybody who picks up a chip's hand, and all the newcomers or out-of-town visitors. It's not moving mountains, but I think it was Mother Teresa said, don't try to do great things, do small things with great love. So yeah. And I got married to somebody that I met in the program. It lasted 8.5 years. They say, I don't know whether it's every one or two of every four people that have addiction problems also have underlying mental health issues. And she had very severe mental health issues. I didn't know that because we dated long distance and I would only see her for brief periods of time. And she was really good at hiding it. But as soon as we got married and lived together, it became quite obvious. So that marriage ended. She decided she didn't want to be married anymore. And I got the house and I got the kids. And so I became a single father. I had three children and I raised my children. And I was very fortunate for that. Although it was very difficult, particularly in the beginning, but I did it. Now that they're all grown and gone, I sometimes think back and I was like, God, how did you even do all that stuff? But you know, I didn't really think about it at the time. I did the next thing that had to be done. So there was that. But as I got into my early 50s and my children were starting to flee the nest, I was also coming to the very end of my career, 32 and a half years. And I said to myself, you know, I haven't really had a social life in a long time. So I was like, I'm going to have a social life. And I'm going to drink as part of that social life. I didn't feel compelled to do it. I made a choice to do it. And I figured alcohol was never my primary drug. Did I abuse it? Yes, I did. But it was never the first thing that I went to. If you're going to stay up all night, you know, coked out, got nothing better to do than drink all night long. So I definitely did abuse it. So in my early 50s, I did that. I started hanging out with people and I started drinking. So I had a lapse in my sobriety. I'm going to disappoint you and tell you that things did not go downhill for me. I continued to build wealth. I had healthy relationships. But I didn't do it all that often. And what happened was over time, I started to dislike the fact that I was a person that did that. And I was able to juxtapose my time being sober to when, you know, now I'm not sober again. And I was, you know, I was just like, I really liked being sober. It's such a great lifestyle. And I also said to myself, you know, I've seen this movie before and I know how it ends. Because my tolerance was increasing. And so I said, no, I have to stop doing this. So I stopped. And that was January 29th, 2021. I had been sober for 23 years, I think. But you know what I'm going to say? I stopped going to meetings because I was working 60 hours a week. I was raising kids. Those are not excuses. But that's what I was doing. And I stopped going to meetings. And so there you have it. On January 29th, 2021, when I decided to stop, I just stopped. It was during the pandemic. And so for the first 9 months, I just stayed sober on my own. Because I thought there were no meetings. I've since found out that there were some. But I didn't know there were any meetings. So I just stayed sober for 9 months on my own. Now I want to say that I heard early on in AA that AA will ruin your drinking. And I think that that's very much true. And then also too, at this point, which I'm going to touch on in a minute, I had 20 years of a meditation practice. So I think those two things together helped buffer it a little bit. And then in October of 2021, all the meetings opened back up again. And I went to an AA meeting at the Westminster Reformed Presbyterian Church. And I didn't feel embarrassed about it. I knew I would be welcomed. And I was welcomed with open arms. And so that makes me like 2.5 years sober now. Yeah, January will be 3 years. Yes. And I like going to meetings. I go to, you know, maybe about 3 a week, sometimes 4, maybe more. But I have to tell you that the AA program, like, I know the AA program. I know the steps. Like, they're ingrained in my heart. I carry them with me everywhere I go. If I only practice the things I learn on the meditation cushion while I'm sitting on it and I don't bring them into my life, it's a waste of time. And if I'm only sober when I'm in AA meetings, it's a waste of time. So of course I always carry them with me. But the thing that I really like about AA is the people, the fellowship. I am an introvert by nature, and it's very simple for me to stay at home with my guitar and a stack of books and not see people for weeks and be perfectly fine with that. So it's really good for me to get out of the house 3 or 4 nights a week and go to an AA meeting and just see everybody, shake everybody's hand, you know. And I've been to churches, I've been to lots of things in my life, but just to be in a room with people that are just trying to do the next right thing, I never fail to find that inspiring. And so that's what I really love about the program. I was in an AA meeting in Chesapeake a couple months ago, and somebody shared that they had been in church on Sunday. The pastor told them, told the congregation, if you want to know what real spirituality is, go to an AA meeting. I support that idea 100%. So I want to touch on step 11 real quick. In the late, somewhere in the mid-90s, I was doing one of my favorite things to do, which is just spend hours roaming around in a bookstore. I'm an avid reader. When I came into AA, I read every single piece of literature over and over and over again. And I found two things. I think they're in one of the smaller books that really spoke to me. It really helped me early on. One said that Alcoholics Anonymous is like a cafeteria. When you go into the cafeteria, you don't choose everything. You may choose the roast beef over the meatloaf and the string beans over the corn. You take what's good for you and you leave the other stuff for other people. And that I still use that to this day. The other one said that addiction is like a bus ride from New York to California. If you get on the bus, it'll take you a really long time to reach California. But unless you stop the bus and get off, you will eventually end up in California. California being death, by the way, for anybody who didn't get that. And that made a lot of sense to me. So in the mid-90s, I was roaming around in a bookstore, and I found a book just by its title. To this day, I cannot remember the title. I cannot remember the author. I lost my copy of it. And even with the powers of the intertubes, I cannot find this book. But anyway, it was a book written by a Jesuit priest who had become a Buddhist monk. And he wrote about Buddhist teaching in a vernacular, a Western vernacular. And I read that book and I was fascinated by it. I was hearing things I had never heard before. And so I bought every book I possibly could find on the subject. And I read about it, and I read about it, and I read about it. And I have to admit that I was a little bit angry. I was a little bit angry that I had grown up in a culture that said, oh, there's just one way to do, you know, this. It's only one way, you know. And I was like, gee, why didn't anybody ever tell me that there are, like, other teachings out there and, you know, stuff like that. So I'm a little bit annoyed by that. So I was just reading and reading and reading, and I didn't have to adhere. The thing that was really cool about it was I didn't have to adhere myself to it. It was talking about the way I've always felt. I just didn't know that there was something out there that expressed how I had always felt. And so I kept reading and reading and reading, and it kept saying, oh, but by the way, you have to meditate. You can only understand this stuff on an intellectual level to some degree. It can only be realized experientially through meditation. So I was like, well, I guess I got to learn how to meditate. And so I tried to meditate, and I failed completely. And so I was like, well, I guess I have to find somebody to teach me how to meditate. But I was like, who the hell meditates, you know? And all I could think of was, like, you know, monks in saffron robes. And so I was like, I don't even know where to find that, you know? So I was at work one day, and there's up in Cutchogue, there used to be this little store that was like a general store and had an old lunch counter. So I went there for lunch one day because I was working at the Cutchogue Post Office right across the street, and people would buy newspapers and read them and leave them at the end of the counter so other people could read them. So I picked up this paper and I was reading it, And on the second to last page, there's a little article about a ceremony, a festival, at the local Buddhist temple. But it didn't say where it was. So I took the paper and I went home and I found the publisher's page and I called the newspaper. I said, hey, I read this article. I said, is the reporter here? Because it had his name on it. And they said, oh, yeah, just hold on a second. We'll get him for you. He gets on the phone. I said, hey, I read your article, but it doesn't say where the temple is. So he goes, oh, he goes, get a pen and paper. He says, because you have to write this down, because even the people that live around it don't know it's there. And if you stop and ask somebody, they won't know. So he gave me exact directions. It was in South Norfolk in a really industrial area, and it was tucked away at the end of a dead-end street. So I found my way there, and when I went there, there was no monks there. There was just the guy that owned the property, and he taught yoga, and then he tried to do some simple meditation stuff. But as luck would have it, a resident monk came and started living there. The only problem is that he did not speak any English. He was Vietnamese. And actually, there are like 5 Vietnamese temples in Tidewater area, including one in Suffolk now, and 1 Thai temple in Carrollton, and none of them have a monk that speaks English. None of them. And that's a bit of a drawback. But anyway, I found out when the monk sat. He sat at like 5:30 in the morning, so I just went, and I started sitting with him. But as luck would have it, another monk came, and he had been teaching in Canada for 11 years, and he spoke perfect English. So he said, oh, do you want to be formally trained? There was a small group of about 4 of us, and we said, yeah. So from 98 to the middle of 99, I underwent formal training in Buddhist meditation in the Zen tradition. And I've been practicing this ever since. It is really now the basis for my practice. It's my primary practice. And, you know, it's hard really kind of to talk about it because it reminds me of the expression that the teaching that can be written down or explained is not the true teaching. It's not the true path. The true path is experiential. But my attempt is to spend as much time in the space before definition and rationalization. In other words, to live in the moment. It's a very hard thing to do. Our brains always want to be in the past or in the future. Pasts are just memories we're thinking about in the moment. The future is things that we will probably never do. And of course, we spend a lot of time explaining ourselves to ourselves. Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But that's what we do. And so through 25 years now of meditation, I've come to the realization that I am not my thoughts. I am not my emotions. These are things that occur in my brain. And these things only become thinking or being trapped in emotion when I grab a hold of them. If I don't grab a hold of them, they float right by, just like clouds in the sky. I challenge anybody to have an emotion that lasts more than a matter of minutes. If you don't grab a hold of that, then go back up into your head and go, oh, I'm justified in feeling this anger, and that person's probably, you know, you go back and forth, and there you go. You're on the road, and you're just trapped. And so these things are not permanent. They're impermanent, like all things. It's only when we make them permanent, we try to grasp a hold of them and hold on to them, that they become so problematic. And this is what I've learned. There are many forms of meditation. There are many forms of meditation as people who do it. I don't know anything about them. I only know about the kind that I do. So I'm not advising anybody to do it. If you do meditation on your own, great. You know, however you do it is good for you. Just like however we work the steps is the way that we work the steps. And it works for me, and I've been doing it for a long time. I'm going to end with a little axiom that I try to live by and maybe an expression of hope. The axiom is, all your life surround yourself with people who seek the truth and run like hell from anybody who says they found it. That's a good one to keep. The message of hope is, since you can't always get what you want, let's hope we can want what we have. 5 more points for the Rolling Stone reference. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Greg. It was great. Did not disappoint.